So good morning. It's really nice to see everybody.
Good morning.
I have a lot more experience listening to Dharma talks than giving them, and it's much easier to do the former. but I feel really fortunate to be here today. And a Dharma talk's an opportunity for me to express my current understanding of the Dharma, and also to be a bit of a voice for the Sangha. All of you. So, when I was preparing for this talk, I'm participating in a panel on death and dying this afternoon. So I found my thoughts sort of moving towards that whole topic about, you know, how we die and why we die. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're embodied and that we live in bodies. So that's what I'd like to focus my talk on today. Stephen Levine wrote a beautiful book about dying, and it's called Who Dies? And I was thinking about that, and I also thought it's interesting to look up, well, what dies? You know, what part of us dies? And the process of dying occurs because we have a body, because we are embodied, and we've taken form on this beautiful planet. So as I was thinking about this topic and reading about it and talking to people about the subject of the body and how we view it in Buddhism, how we relate to the body and how we work with the body, I found I got quite confused, which wasn't what my hope was. And I didn't really reach a point of clarity with a few succinct lines to kind of summarize my understanding. So I apologize for that. But I also think that this is okay. It's very Zen. And so I'm going to present to you some thoughts and questions and some words that I have found from the Buddha and from Dogen, who's one of our Soto Zen teachers, and some other wise beings, and leave you with the questions that I have about it. So last weekend I was traveling to Bellingham for a retreat, and as I went through customs, I was asked where I was going and for what purpose, the very common thing. And I replied that I was going to a Buddhist meditation retreat. And the customs officer turned out to be quite interested in this, and she asked me if this was the type of meditation where they taught you to go out of your body. So I answered, no, it's not. And I didn't embark on an entire Dharma talk about it because I wanted to save that for today. And I was also aware of the lineup of cars behind me. But it did get me thinking about what the Buddhist views are on the body, you know, how we use the body and relate to it in Buddhism. And I think it's common in spiritual practices to regard the body as impure and as a distraction that obstructs holiness and enlightenment. And this different spiritual practices have different views about the body. And I'd like to read a bit from John O'Donohue, a book called Anamkara. He was an Irish Catholic priest who left the priesthood and has written a lot about Celtic wisdom and spirituality. The body is much sinned against, even in a religion based on the incarnation. Religion has often presented the body as the source of evil, ambiguity, lust, and seduction. This is utterly false and irreverent. The body is sacred. The origin of much of this negative thinking is in a false interpretation of Greek philosophy. The Greeks were beautiful thinkers precisely because of the emphasis they placed on the divine. The divine haunted them, and they endeavored in language and concept to echo the divine and find some mirror for its presence. They were acutely aware of the gravity in the body and how it seemed to drag the divine too much toward the earth. They misconceived this attraction to the earth and saw in it a conflict with the world of the divine. When the Christian tradition incorporated Greek philosophy, it brought this dualism into its thought world. The soul was understood as beautiful, bright, and good. The desire to be with God belonged to the nature of the soul. Were it not for the unfortunate gravity of the body, the soul could constantly inhabit the eternal. In this way, a great suspicion of the body entered the Christian tradition. So how is the body viewed in Buddhism? Buddhism is non-theistic, so there's not the same sense of being separate from God and seeing the soul as our means to connect or reunite. And Buddhist meditation practice is very much focused on the body. Jantosen Bays, who's a teacher in Portland, once told me that you meditate with your body, not your mind. And I was immediately captivated by that, and I went, oh, that's really true, but I didn't really get it, and I still don't really, but I keep kind of working with that. But it is true, we come to the cushion, we place our body on the cushion, we sit upright, pay attention to the breath, and it's very much embodied. The Buddha gave a discourse or a teaching, as he did many, and one of his early ones was on mindfulness, and it was called the Satipatthana Sutra. And I've read it in this book by Thich Nhat Hanh called Transformation and Healing. And this is one of his early teachings, and it's focused on mindfulness and on the four foundations of mindfulness. So it's like the four basic important things about mindfulness. And the first foundation is mindfulness of the body. So I'm going to read a little bit from this. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh writing. He says, mindfulness is always mindfulness of something. There are four areas of mindfulness, four areas where mindfulness has to penetrate. In order for us to be protected, for joy to be nourished, for pain to be transformed, and for insight to be obtained. These are called the four establishments of mindfulness. These four establishments, or foundations, are body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind. So the very first one is the body, mindfulness of the body. So it's given a lot of emphasis in the sutra first by being first and by the amount of time spent on it. And the message is clearly that in order to practice, like to become mindful and, let's face it, enlightened, we must pay attention to the body. So the words in the first establishment, he says, what are the four establishments? And he's speaking to an audience of monks who are called bhikkhus. And he says, bhikkhus, a practitioner remains established in the observation of the body, in the body. Diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. This is how a practitioner observes the body in the body. And it's interesting that he uses that word. It's observing the body in the body, sort of a double. He observes the body from within or from without, or from both within and without. He observes the process of coming to be in the body, or the process of disillusion in the body, or both the process of coming to be and the process of disillusion. Or he is mindful of the fact, there is a body here, until understanding and full awareness come about. He maintains the observation, free, not caught up in any worldly consideration. That is how to practice observation of the body in the body, O bhikkhus. So, and first of all, in this sutra, the Buddha instructs us to be mindful of the body by paying attention to the breathing, and being aware of breathing in and of breathing out, and lots of detail about that. Be aware of long breaths and short breaths, of breathing into the whole body and of calming the body. And that sounds like a lot of what we do when we're sitting, when we come and sit on our cushions, as we sit down, pay attention to breathing. So we're meditating with our body. And in the next sections, he goes into a lot of detail about being aware of the parts of the body and the elements that make up the body and what happens to the body after death. So it's a lot of training and mindfulness of just what is the nature of the body, the impermanence of it. And some of this can be seen as fostering a sense of impurity or of even disgust for the body, because he goes into a lot of detail, which I'll read a little bit about. I don't really see it that way, because I've always been really interested in how the body's put together and how it works, and it's an incredible machine. It does, you know, little miracles every second, every day as we're sitting here. It's like the things that are going on are just amazing. Then the Buddha, I think, wasn't, I don't really think, intending to put people off the body and see it as something really impure and distasteful, but was really aware of how attached people get to their bodies. And this was a way of, you know, releasing that hindrance of attachment, of really looking at the nature of the body. So I think as an antidote, he had us focus on how the body is merely a collection of pieces which come and go and are not permanent, they're not us. So the instructions go, further, the practitioner meditates on his very own body, from the soles of the feet upwards, and then from the hair on the top of the head downwards. A body contained inside the skin and full of all the impurities which belong to the body. Here is the hair of the head, the hairs on the body, the nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, bowels, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, mucus, synovic fluid, urine. So this is all part of one of the early sutras of the Buddha, teaching us about how to meditate. And apparently there were some monks who, after he gave this talk, went out and practiced this really deeply and became so appalled by the nature of the body that they actually killed themselves to be free of it. And that's written in some of the Pali canons. And when the Buddha heard of this, he was a little bit distressed. That wasn't the intention, so he kind of changed the nature of what he was saying. And then this, so it goes a lot into the just looking at the parts of the body, and then the elements that make up the body. And in Buddhism, there's either four or six elements that are seen to make up our existence. Further, in whichever position his body happens to be, the practitioner passes in review the elements which constitute the body. In this body is the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So this exercise shows us the interrelationship of our body and all that is in the universe. It's one of the principal ways of witnessing for ourselves the non-self, unborn, and never-dying nature of all that is. Seeing things in this way can liberate and awaken us. The sutra teaches us that we should be aware of the presence of earth, water, fire, and air elements in our body. These are the four great elements, also referred to as the realms. The earth element represents the hard, solid nature of matter. The water element represents the liquid, permeating nature. The fire element represents heat, and the air element represents movement. So in the sutra, this is still in the first part of the sutra, the first foundation with mindfulness of the body. It then goes on to looking at the dissolution of the body after death. And this is really quite fascinating, I think. And there's a lot of instruction about going and observing the stages of decay of a corpse, and that this was actually practiced a lot. I don't know if it still is. It's not really available to us here. But in the Buddha's time, you could go to the charnel grounds and see the corpses and see what happened to the body. And this goes into lots of detail. There's actually 9 stages that the Buddha talks about of looking at the body in decay after death. And he felt that this was a really good practice. For monks to do. So the 9 contemplations for the 9 stages of decomposition of a corpse. So I'm just going to read them through, and in the sutra it goes into a fair bit of detail, but 1, the corpse is bloated, blue, and festering. 2, the corpse is crawling with insects and worms. Crows, hawks, vultures, and wolves are tearing it apart to eat. 3, all that is left is a skeleton with some flesh and blood still clinging to it. For all that is left is a skeleton with some blood stains, but no more flesh. 5. All that is left is a skeleton with no more blood stains. 6. All that is left is a collection of scattered bones. Here an arm, here a shin, here a skull, and so forth. 7. All that is left is a collection of bleached bones. 8. All that is left is a collection of dried bones. 9. The bones have decomposed, and only a pile of dust is left. And with each of these contemplations and all of these stages, he always ends up with saying, this body of mine is of the same nature. It will end up in the same way. There is no way it can avoid that state. So it's really, you know, really being mindful, really understanding the impermanence of the physical form. Some words from a meditation on the elements of the body. It says, everything within this body has come from outside this body. Not a single molecule of solid matter within this body is self-originated. It is all borrowed, and we will give it back. In fact, we are giving it back every moment of our lives. All cells in our body are in a constant process of dissolving and rebuilding. And it's really interesting. It's estimated with cell replacement, cell replacement, tissue remodeling, that there's an equivalent to the turnover of an adult's total body weight every 18 to 24 months. So it's like every within that time we get a brand new set of parts and give that set of parts back too. So the body is impermanent. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. Thich Nhat Hanh says about the observation of the decay of the body, its intention is not to make us weary of life, but to help us see how precious life is. Not to make us pessimistic, but to help us see the impermanent nature of life, so we don't waste our lives. If we have the courage to see things as they are, our meditation will have beneficial results. When we see the impermanent nature of things, we appreciate their true value. So I got some interesting a lot of feelings doing this meditation, and that's the next part of mindfulness is mindfulness of feelings. But they're not all pleasant feelings that I get when I'm thinking about the decay of the body and just the impermanence, because it is easy to get attached to being here, having this body, being alive, and I think it's a good way to shake things up a little bit. But you could see looking at this exercise as applying that the body being impermanent is something separate from us, different from our minds. But as in most delightful Buddhist paradoxes, this is not the only way to see it. It is and it isn't. So when we're sitting mindfully and paying attention to the body and the breath, we can create a oneness of body and mind. And I think that Thich Nhat Hanh really describes that really beautifully here in looking at the practice of mindfulness of the body. Because earlier on in the sutra, when we're looking at breathing, it says, breathing in, I am aware of my whole body. Breathing out, I am aware of my whole body. So this third exercise in the sutra is to bring body and mind into harmony. The element used to bring this about is the breath. In meditation practice, the distinction between body and mind dissolves, and we talk of the oneness of body and mind. In this exercise, the object of our mindfulness is no longer simply the breath, but the whole body itself, as it is unified with the breath. And he talks about how you can, by calming any one of those three, the body, the mind, or the breath, they automatically calm the other one. So if you bring yourself on your cushion, sit in a comfortable, relaxed position, have your muscles relaxed. That tends to automatically calm your breath, and then what follows is your mind gets calmed. And if you work with any one or two of those, it brings unity and calmness to the other ones. And you can create a real oneness of body and mind. So the body is our home here. It's where we find our place in time and space. And it's always in the present, and it brings us back every time we tune in. And I think you know, in the end, we can really trust our bodies. They're always in the present. I once heard somebody say, the only thing I trust is my cushion and my feet. And it's like when things are going around in your life and you're just not sure where anything is, you always can, you know, sit still, you can breathe, you can feel your feet and come back. And that's a really valuable thing. Again, I'm from John O'Donohue. He describes the body as a sacrament. The old traditional definition of sacrament captures this beautifully. A sacrament is a visible sign of invisible grace. In that definition, there is a fine acknowledgement of how the unseen world comes to expression in the visible world. This desire for expression lies deep at the heart of the invisible world. All our inner life and intimacy of soul longs to find an outer mirror. It longs for a form in which it can be seen, felt, and touched. The body is the mirror where the secret world of the soul comes to expression. The body is a sacred threshold, and it deserves to be respected, minded, and understood in its spiritual nature. I was thinking about how we look at our bodies in relationship to bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is absolute and relative bodhicitta, and it's absolute bodhicitta is like that place where there's total love and total acceptance, and everything that exists and is happening is perfect and whole just as it is. It's that whole sense of being in God's hands, of being cared for and not having to worry, the kind of be happy, don't worry approach. And then relative bodhicitta, and they're very related, is the part where we have to do some work, and we see the suffering, we see the imbalance, and we work to create harmony and bring peace to it. And if you look at the body that way, the sort of absolute bodhicitta or absolute love of the body is being really in love with being here, being embodied, of being in this physical presence, and just being truly okay with it all. Honoring and respecting this kind of pivotal opportunity of human birth. And then relative bodhicitta is where you need to do some work to keep it all together and keep it going. And with the body, there's a lot, you know. It's like we to clean it and clothe it and feed it and do all the things to care for it, including, you know, paying attention, doing things that are healing. I think sometimes one can get caught in, or certain people can go, well, I don't really need to do anything to take care of my body because I can just meditate and I'll completely become one and heal everything. But I think that it's also good to pay attention to doing things, seeing doctors, if you believe in them. Exercise, stretching, massage, caring touch, all those things that are nurturing to the body. And then, you know, thinking about body and living, you automatically turn to the end of life and the end of the body. And in Buddhism, this talk about death and rebirth and what dies and who dies. Is there rebirth? Really, really good questions. And Dogen, he was a 13th century Japanese Zen master whose writings are studied extensively in our Soto Zen lineage. In one of his essays, The Genjo Koan, he has a beautiful paragraph, kind of poetic, that speaks a bit of this. About that whole thing, about the dissolution and birth and rebirth. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future, and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. I'm going to close with a poem by a Polish poet, Szymborska, and it's called On Death Without Exaggeration. On Death Without Exaggeration. It can't take a joke, find a star, make a bridge. It knows nothing about weaving, mining, farming, building ships, or baking cakes. In our planning for tomorrow, it has the final word, which is always beside the point. It can't even get the things done that are part of its trade. Dig a grave, make a coffin, clean up after itself. Preoccupied with killing, it does the job awkwardly, without system or skill, as though each of us were its first kill. Oh, it has its triumphs, but look at all its countless defeats, missed blows, and repeat attempts. Sometimes it isn't strong enough to swat a fly from the air. Many are the caterpillars that have outcrawled it. All those bulbs, pods, tentacles, fins, trachea, nuptial plumage, and winter fur show that it has fallen behind with its half-hearted work. Ill will won't help, and even our lending a hand with wars and coup d'etat is so far not enough. Hearts beat inside eggs. Babies' skeletons grow. Seeds, hard at work, sprout their first tiny pair of leaves. And sometimes even tall trees fall away. Whoever claims that it's omnipotent is himself living proof that it's not. There's no life that couldn't be immortal, if only for a moment. Death always arrives by that very moment too late. In vain it tugs at the knob of the invisible door. As far as you've come, can't be undone. So thank you for being here and for your attention to my words this morning. And may you hold your body with reverence and respect and allow it to ground you in the Buddha way.